Chapter 1. A small detail, almost inconsequential, but important nevertheless. A creature no larger than a man's thumb. A winged clade with a segmented carapace and a brittle exoskeleton of variegated puce. Atop its head, whip-like antennae tasted the myriad new scents flavouring the air, moving with uncharacteristic slowness as toxic numbness spread throughout its body. The creature, a Caudatus vespidae, moved with a drunken gait across the churned red mud of the hillside, buffeted by warring thermals gusting from the earthworks sprawling at its base like a virulent plague. Skybound anabatic winds carried the smells of war, burned iron, smoky chemical propellants, musky post-human oils, lubricant, and blood. To any student of entomology, the creature's behaviour would have seemed strange, to say the least. Its feeder mandibles snapped at nothing, and its legs twitched as though rogue impulses were firing from its tripartite brain along its nerve stems, like a palsy. Its hive nest had once been situated in the waving branches of a tall palander tree, but shellfire had long since reduced the stepped banks of agri terraces to a cratered wasteland of splintered stumps. Fire had gutted the nest's interior and killed the hive queen, though residual traces of excreted pheromone resins had been strong enough to guide the vespidae back home. Whether pure instinct or a desire to die within its former home had driven the creature to ascend the muddy ridges of the hillside would never be known. But whatever ambition had driven it to complete its upward odyssey was to be thwarted. Its body finally succumbed to the paralyzing toxin injected with a murderous thoroughness, and the vespidae ceased its upward climb. It sat, unmoving, on a flattened berm of earth beneath a shattered terrace of reflective stone. Jutting lengths of rusted steelwork radiated from the wall like spread fingers with the ends burned black. The creature appeared to be dead, but its belly and flanks still rippled with motion. Its head bulged and swelled as its internal structure seemed to rove within its exoskeleton with a frantic desire to reshape itself. Wriggling motion shook its carapace, undulant pressure bending its flexible segments outwards as though they sought to fly away and abandon its dying form. A chitinous plate detached from the creature's body, and beneath it writhed a gelatinous worm-like extrusion, a parasitic passenger sating its newborn hunger by feasting on its host's internal organs. The cannibalizing organism pulled itself from the shell of its birth vessel, its flesh already hardening in the air. From translucency to opacity in a heartbeat, its rapidly forming carapace was a riot of shimmering hues, a wondrous oil spill of colors designed to beguile and entrance. The cracked and husked-out remains of its vespidae host crumbled under the weight of the growing creature, its morphogenesis progressing at a staggering rate. From a split along the middle, gossamer wings unfolded, dragonfly long in proportion to its body, and edged with a membranous web of trailing cilia. With its wings beginning to beat, a segmented tail of shimmering gold and jet unfolded from beneath the cuckoo creature to give it perfect symmetry. Though its birth had been horrific and needlessly cruel, its final form was undeniably beautiful. An elegant swan hatched from a bloody carcass, a reminder that even the most terrible cruelty can fashion the greatest beauty. An iron-shod boot slammed down, crushing the newborn creature into the mud beneath its tread. Brutal proof, if proof were needed, that the living world existed with no thoughts of compassion, justice, or mercy. The owner of the boot, clad in the hulking plates of cataphracty terminator armor, stared at the smoke-wreathed mountain and the golden citadel crowning its summit. Unaware of the tiny life he had just snuffed out, Forex scanned the blasted terraces of the Cadmean citadel, grudgingly admiring the elegance with which it had been integrated into the local topology and the surrounding city. The war masons of the imperial fists were cold and efficient, but their master understood the first maxim of the victor, that the best people to leave in the wake of your campaigns were those who did not feel they had been conquered. It was a maxim to which the iron warriors pay little heed.
The conqueror makes fair his walls, and all should welcome him as a liberator, said Forex, looking back over his shoulder to the wide valley below.
Sawtooth fortifications surrounded the citadel in jagged layers of razor wire and pugnacious walls, bludgeoning their way across the lower town and tearing through habitations, agriculture, industry, and places of wondrous natural beauty with equal aplomb. Redoubts, bunkers, and high-walled dungeons grew like rocky stalagmites in a dripping cave, and a pall of smoke hung low over the dusty red valley, like a shroud. The lower reaches of the promontory at the heart of the great starport were now clad in metal, each dawn revealing a higher course of steelwork and scaffolds that crept uphill like a spreading cancer that would climb and climb until the red and ochre skin of the mountain was entirely encased. Freshly laid funicular rails came with the steelwork, heavy gauge tracks that would allow mighty bombards and howitzers to be raised into battery positions, hacked into the stepped bedrock. Thus far, the basilisk workhorses of the siege train had shouldered the bulk of the barrage work, but the heavier guns were only days away from being brought high enough to lob fat cauldrons of high explosive into the heart of the citadel. And when that happened, it was all over. No fortress could long resist when the lords of the artilleryman's craft were brought to bear. The iron warriors would flatten Dawn's mountain and erase all trace of the Cadmean citadel, heedless of the technological marvels worked into its walls. Forex watched the progress of a group of captured city folk hauling long lengths of steel-wound cable uphill, sweating and blooded by the effort and driven by the whips of Obak Zagayo. Behind them, clawed and spider-limbed construction engines drilled into the mountain to lace its structure with the bolts, fasteners and clamps required of the siege masters behind them. There was a relentless and pleasing regularity to the work, a dance of logistics, effort and planning that only those versed in the arts of making and unmaking fortifications could appreciate. Amid the brutality, the slavery, the misery and the rape of the landscape, there was art, and there was beauty, of a strange, underappreciated kind.
"Admiring your handiwork again, Triarch," said Barban Falk, climbing into the shielded observation post below the ruined outwork that marked the point where the Imperial fists had first broken the earth of this world.
"No, admiring theirs,"
he replied, jerking his head uphill. Smoke hung over the citadel, its walls pocked and scarred by shellfire, but already wreathed in a haze of ancient mechanisms of self-repair. Driving dust squalls and oppressed sunshine rippled in the mirage of its void shields, throwing up splintered rainbows of distorted light.
"You always did like living dangerously, didn't you, Forex?" said Falk, the enormous bulk of their armour filling the small space.
Forex didn't have to ask what he meant. Since the debacle at Fal, to speak of the Sons of Dawn with anything other than hate was to invite terrible retribution from the Lord of Iron. Had it been anyone else, Forex wouldn't have spoken. But as far as any Iron warrior ever trusted another, he trusted Barban Falk.
"I know you think the same," he said.
"True. But I know better than to voice it."
"You always played the politics better than I did," admitted Forex.
"Yet you hold a position in the Trident and have the ear of the Primarch."
"Precious few of us can claim that now," said Forex, with an honesty that surprised him.
Falk shrugged, no easy feat in such a bulky suit of armour.
His monstrous terminator plates were chevroned with gold and jet, and the smoothness of the heavy barrel-vaulted pauldrons was in stark contrast to the war-worn condition of Forex's armour. Falk's battle gear had originally been crafted for Warsmith Dantioch of the 51st Expedition, but after the triple disasters of Golgis, Stratopoli, and Crack Fiorina, it had been reassigned to a more deserving wearer. Like Fal, no iron warrior now mentioned Dantioch. His legacy was utterly expunged, his name a byword for failure on an epic scale.
"I do not claim to understand our master's mind, but I can read the tides of his anger," said Falk, flexing the chisel-like fingers of his power fist as though carefully weighing his next words. "Tides that grow ever stronger and more frequent."
"How are the western approaches?" asked Forex, unwilling to address Falk's comment.
Falk chuckled.
"Do you think I am trying to entrap you, Forex?"
said the giant warrior, running a hand over his oiled dark hair and narrowing his already hooded eyes.
"You think I seek to goad you into careless words I can then report back to the Primarch? If I had any feelings to be hurt, they would be bleeding to death right now."
Forex allowed himself a thin smile.
"No, I don't think that," he said.
"Well, you should," said Falk. "I'd betray you in a heartbeat if I thought it would earn me a place in the Trident, especially now that Golg's a corpse and Berossus is as good as a corpse and isn't likely to be elevated."
"Complete the western approaches in the next day, and you might get your wish."
Falk nodded and pulled a waxy sheet of rolled parchment from the kilt of baked leather at his waist. He passed it to Forex, who pulled it open and cast his eye over Falk's schematics.
"The work is proceeding as planned," said Falk,
his pride and vaunting ambition plain.
"The breaching batteries will be in place by sundown tonight, and ground-penetrating Auspex readings suggest a wall density that will require a 16-hour bombardment to carve a practicable breach in the Half-Moon Bastion."
Forex let his eyes wander the interleave lines on Falk's plans, the angles of approach, the interlocking fire pockets, the dead zones, and the enfilading redoubts, admiring the brutal, functional architecture of his fellow warsmith's plans.
"I see you favour extra storm bastions over breaching batteries," he said.
Falk had always preferred the blunt directness of frontal assault over the relentless mathematics of a carefully planned approach. Where Forex viewed the reduction of a fortress as a rigorously applied equation, Falk saw it as a pugilistic battle where both fighters pounded until one was forced to yield. An unsubtle mindset, but an effective one. Many beyond the Legion believe this to be the Iron Warrior's only means of waging war, but the Lord of Iron was far more subtle than that. Mathematics and the precise application of force made up the bulk of his campaigning, but the brute application of violence made far more dramatic remembrance.
"There are enough guns to bring the walls down, even allowing for those damned repair mechanisms," replied Falk. "Once the wall's down, I want enough warriors in place to be sure of punching through the breach. They won't be expecting an escalade in the west."
"There's a reason for that," pointed out Forex. "The ground there is steeper and rockier than the other flanks. It won't be easy to cover that ground quickly enough to avoid getting shot to pieces. And if there are seismic charges in place, they'll bury you."
"There won't be."
"How can you be so sure?"
"The Lord of Iron says there will not be."
"You have spoken to the Primarch?"
asked Forex, struggling to mask the bilious jealousy flaring in his breast.
"He has not emerged from his bunker since we made planetfall."
"He sends word through the stone rot,"
spat Falk, referring to Sultan Vulbron, a warrior of the 45th Grand Battalion, whose understanding of stone was such that, some whispered, it spoke to him, confiding its secrets and opening up its geological wonders to the touch of his entrenching tool. Perturabo, ever quick to recognize raw talent, now favoured Vulbron,
Despite the inferiority of his rank, next to the three exalted warsmiths of the Trident, who normally attended upon him.
Does he send word of the Third Legion?
Falk shook his head.
No, he demands only that Cassander's men must be all dead and this citadel in ruins before the Phoenicians' warriors arrive.
Forex grunted, his measure of the Emperor's children's worth wordlessly expressed.
This prosecution will be done with long before then.
As if to underscore Forex's words, the percussive drumbeat of artillery fire echoed from the far side of the mountain. Both warriors looked up as the echoes were carried away by the hot winds whipping around the mountainside. Forex listened to the rhythm of the guns, as a maestro listens to the orchestra at his command, reading the subtle shifts in pitch and timbre of each weapon. He heard the urgency in the firing and the haste with which each gun was unleashing its explosive ordnance.
"It's coming from the north,"
said Forex, reaching for the helmet maglocked to his armour.
"Harkers, warriors," replied Falk.
"Come on,"
said Forex, turning and stalking from the observation post.
"That's not breaching fire," said Falk, arriving at the conclusion Forex had already reached.
"No," agreed Forex. "The bloody fool's mounting an escalade."
Pain. It always came back to pain.
Berossus's last memory had been of pain, of his life bleeding out through the broken meat puppet his flesh had become. Bones smashed beyond the ability of any apothecary to knit, organs pulped with seismic force and the searing heat in his flesh as the fearsome power of his genhanced metabolism tried in vain to undo the mortal wound done to him. The pain was intense, and had never left him. But worse than the pain was the shame of how he had been wounded. Not at the hands of an enemy warrior capable of wreaking harm on a battle-engineered post-human, nor at the hands of a terrible alien creature too hideous and nightmarish for him to overcome. No, this pain had been wrought by the hands of his Primarch. The blow had been swift, too swift to avoid, and too thorough in its unmaking of his body for him ever to recover. Another had swiftly followed, an unnecessary blow, for he was already dead by any conventional measure of the word. But the Fourth Legion never did anything half-heartedly, and Perturabo's attack was that martial philosophy distilled into two swift strikes. Gulping blood down his ruptured esophagus and frothing it out through his perforated lungs, Berossus had waited to die as he had lived, embittered and in pain. Ever since the war against the Black Judges and the screaming mob of hooded accusators that had caught him off guard, he had lived with pain. Individually, the accusators were no match for a warrior of the Legiones Astartes, but he had been surrounded by a dozen, each armed with a chain gavel that could cut armour apart with lethal ease. Six died before they could touch him, but then their blows began to tell, cutting him apart piece by piece until the tearing teeth of an enemy weapon had all but ripped through his spine. He'd killed them all with the last of his strength before falling to the ground as his legs failed him. The apothecaries had found him surrounded by their black hooded bodies and worked wonders on his injured flesh. His body was remade and strengthened with augmetics and nerve grafts, but the pain of the ordeal never left him. That pain had been eclipsed in one moment of incautious speaking. It had been his misfortune to bring ill-favoured news to the Lord of Iron, whose volatile moods had steadily worsened since the slaughters of Istvan V. He had known his news was bad, but had hoped his position as a warsmith would keep him from harm. A foolish hope, for Perturabo's rages fell on high kings and holy fools alike. Since then, blackness, for the most part. Muttered voices, sudden stabbing light, and a sensation of floating disembodied on a dark ocean. He felt dislocated,
adrift and bereft of all the points of reference he had until now taken for granted. Berossus had tried to listen to the beat of his heart, thinking that if he could cling to that metronomic beat, then he might have some means, however transitory, of measuring the passage of time. Yet his heart was silent, and in his timeless madnesses he would often wonder if he had died and was trapped in some heathen limbo. He rejected the thought, but it would return to plague him often, a nagging suspicion that his life was over, yet would not end. Memories intruded as he floated between life and death, a parade of conquest in service of the Emperor and latterly Warmaster Horus. He saw wars fought in the red rain, dug through the flesh of countless worlds, and ripped the meat from the bones of 100,000 foes. He saw righteous wars of species survival fought by the light of Terra's sun, twist under the transformative pressure of time, becoming wars of conquest, which in time became wars fought for the sake of the vicarious thrill of it. When had that happened? How had the martial traditions of the Iron Warriors been perverted so completely? But Rossus knew the answer well enough. Piece by piece, inch by inch, the Emperor's wars had worn the proud warriors of the Fourth Legion down to little more than grinding machines, bedecked in the blood and mud of the worlds they dragged into compliance. Perturabo's warriors had done all that had been asked of them, and their only reward was to be thrown back to the very wars that were poisoning the heart of their legion. And then the bitterest pill to swallow. Berossus remembered the words Warmaster Horus had spoken to the Lord of Iron after the wrack of lost Olympia and the news that the wolves of Fenris had been loosed upon the fair Isle of Prospero.
"The use of force alone is a temporary solution," Horus had said. "It may subdue for a moment, but it does not remove the necessity of subduing again. And the Imperium will not be at peace if we must perpetually reconquer those we have rendered compliant. You, my brother, will ensure that one conquest is enough."
Perhaps the Warmaster's words had been intended as a balm for Perturabo's tortured soul, but so dark a benediction had only driven him deeper into abyssal guilt. What might once have appeared as the basest of treacheries now seemed like the only logical course, and Perturabo had reaffirmed his oaths of loyalty to Horus. No one knew what else had passed between these two demigods, but when the Iron Warriors had set foot on Istvan V, it was with a murderous rage that could only be quenched in the blood of those they had once called brothers. Berossus floated through the chaos of the massacre on the black sand, the savage joy he had taken in the shock of betrayal on the faces of every midnight-skinned salamander and ivory-faced raven guard. Of the Iron Hands he had seen little, for the Phoenicians' warriors were making sport of them, their debaucheries unseemly but effective. He remembered killing a salamander's captain with a close-range blast of his melter gun, relishing the irony of ending his life with fire. The warrior's helmet had run molten from his face, leaving the skull exposed and as black as the skin that sloughed from the bone like hot oil. Even as he died, the warrior had cursed him in a bubbling series of liquid gasps that made no sense. He'd left the salamander to choke on his own liquidized flesh, dismissing the curse as a vestigial remnant of his upbringing on a feral world of savage-born reptile hunters. Drifting in this timeless limbo of pain and isolation, the salamander's molten visage returned to haunt his nightmares, a leering skull with coal-red eyes that bored into him with accusatory force. The screaming skull never left him, braying meaningless static and pressing close to his awareness, forcing him to relive the agonies it had known in its final moments. Behind the skull,
was another face, a bitter granite-carved mask with cold blue-steel eyes and a voice before which all else was white noise. It commanded the blackened bone of the salamander, telling it that Berossus would not die as everything else had died. Even in his disembodied state, Berossus knew these were commands that could not be ignored. The salamander's skull brought life, but most of all, it brought pain, its red eyes reducing him to scraps with chanted evocations. Berossus tried to retreat from its calls, but it had strength beyond what was left to him and a hunger for his suffering. He felt a jolt of screaming agony course around his body, a shuddering paroxysm of electric rebirth, and even as dimensions of space and form coalesced around him, he loosed a shuddering roar as he felt the immense power in his limbs. The world of darkness in which he had existed for what felt like an eternity was washed away in a cascade of painful colours that made him want to close his eyes. The colours bled away, but not his rage, and he shook as he saw the salamander's red-eyed skull before him. Except it wasn't a salamander, and it wasn't a skull. The Techmarine's eye lenses were whirring optics, enlarged orbs of clicking armatures, and rotating ruby lenses mounted on a bulbous apparatus of bronze and silver. His helm was blackened iron, and a trio of hissing pneumatics crouched at his shoulders like obedient stingers of metal and dripping fluids.
"Who are you?"
he said, his voice a grating bark that sounded nothing like he remembered.
"I am Galleon Charon, and you are in my warforge," said the Tech Marine, who stepped back with a wary flinch as Berossus shook in the unbreakable fetters that bound him. Charon was looking up at him, for he was taller by far than the Tech Marine. Grey-fleshed servitors and heavy lifter gear stood around him, some before him, some behind him, though how he could see them was at present a mystery. A host of robed acolytes bearing oiled platters, upon which were a variety of cogs, gear and machine parts, knelt behind Charon, the Tech Marine's devotees. No, not Charon's devotees. His.
"Why am I here?"
asked Berossus, feeling unfamiliar walls of cold iron pressing in around him, a life-preserving womb and a sarcophagus all in one. Claustrophobic madness extended a tendril into his mind and found itself welcome.
"You are here because the Lord of Iron willed it so," said Charon.
"You lie!"
said Berossus, desperate and yet hopeful.
"He killed me."
"No, he has transformed you."
"I don't understand," said Berossus.
"By his own hand he has remade you in his image," said Charon, as one of his wheezing pneumatics reached up and took hold of a rubberized control box. At the press of a button, the fetters binding Berossus's limbs unclamped with a mechanized sound of grinding metal. His legs, twin columns of iron, steel and fibre bundle muscles, were his again to command, and he took a ponderous step forwards, knowing, with his first, that there would be no release from this entombment in an iron coffin. The sound of his splay-clawed footfalls rang from the floor plates of the warforge with a boom of metal on metal. His arms, a monumental hammer and a heavy-barreled rotor cannon, spun in time with his thoughts.
"I am alive?"
asked Berossus, not yet ready to believe it.
"Better," said Charon. "You are a dreadnought."
Holding the citadel had never been a possibility. Captain Felix Cassander of the Imperial Fists knew, but that had never been the point. The Iron Warriors were the enemy, and though his thoughts still balked at the thought of the Legiones Astartes turning upon one another,
the enemy had to be fought. Yes, the citadel must eventually fall, but Cassander did not hold with the notion of the unwinnable fight, the noble last stand, or poetic notions of self-sacrifice. There was always a way to win, or at least a way to cheat death, but even he had to admit that there was only the faintest hope of them surviving much longer. Cassander was not a man to whom pessimism came easily, but it was taking considerable effort of will to keep its dark touch from infecting his thoughts. When the Iron Warriors finally overcame the citadel's ancient defences and broke open its walls, they would run amok. They would slaughter his warriors, the heroic men and women of this world that had chosen to stand with them, and the refugees from the murder fields below. 52 imperial fists and 13,000 men, women and children were crammed within the citadel's walls. When the end came, their deaths would not be quick, and they would not be painless. But there was no talk of surrender or terms, no seditious mutterings to erode morale, and no thought other than resisting these bastard invaders. The Iron Warriors, our brothers. No history told who had built this marvel atop the mountain, though the engineers and artisans who had raised its living walls must surely have been the greatest minds of their age. Wrought from stone and rock unknown to this world, and laced with technologies whose secrets not even the Mechanicum could fathom, its walls reacted to damage like living tissue. Shell impacts would scab over with liquid silicates, and moments later the wall beneath would be whole again. Only when the hurt was so sustained and so catastrophic would any site of damage be irreparable. Attackers found the wall reacting to them with spiked extrusions of living rock, or were swallowed whole as the stonework opened up beneath them. Against any conventional foe, the fortress would have been, for all intents and purposes, impregnable and indestructible. But the Iron Warriors were not conventional foes. Lord Dorne had chosen the living citadel as the site upon which to plant the Aquila. Not as a symbol of imperial dominance, but a seat of governance to be shared by all. He had brought the planet's former rulers into the establishment of an ordered government, allowing the people to choose their own planetary governor, a respected civic leader named Endric Cadmus. Cassander smiled at the memory, thinking that perhaps some of the philosophy of the 13th Legion's Primarch had permeated the Imperial Fists after all. Cassander and his fellow Imperial Fists had escorted the expeditionary iterators and remembrancers as they went from cities to far-flung townships, spreading word of the Emperor to a people ripe to embrace the Imperial truth. It had been a glorious time, and when Lord Dorne announced that he was to lead the 7th Legion to fresh campaigns, the populace had mourned his departure like the loss of a loved one. He remembered the pride that had filled him when the Primarch had given him the solemn duty of standing with his battle company as sentinels to the newly compliant world, a potent sign that this was a world under the protection of the Imperial Fists. But that honourable gesture was to have consequences that not even Lord Dorne could have foreseen. Cassander wiped dust from his scarred face and spat a mouthful of the wretched stuff to the ground, where it bubbled with a chemical hiss. His helmet was long gone. A bolt round had punched through the faceplate and blown out in a spray of blood, bone and ceramite. Tech Marine Scanion had died early in the fight, and without his direction, the forge servitors were of only limited use when it came to repair work. A few Mechanicum adepts remained, but they spent their days in the heart of the citadel, plumbing its secrets as though there were still a chance they might live to relay anything they might find. Cassander's features were careworn, as though abraded by the constant winds that scoured every smooth surface on this planet and gave it the texture of coarse sand. Eyes of deep brown that had seen the order of the galaxy overturned without any power to change it were deep-set and melancholic. His cheeks scar-blackened with the explosive passage of the bolt round that had taken his helm. When the order came to return to Terra, Cassander began preparations to depart immediately, but the sudden death of his vessel's navigator had left them stranded until a replacement could be dispatched. The following day, word of the War Master's treachery and the massacre on Istvan V reached them, throwing Cassander's world into freefall. Pride in an honourable assignment was replaced by frustration and bitter disappointment that they could not fight alongside their brothers, could not call Horus to account for his perfidy and punish those who had trampled their oaths of loyalty into the dust. But the chance to make war on the traitorous allies of Horus had come soon enough. The Iron Warriors made planetfall in the wake of a saturation bombardment that reduced the valley and the agri-settlements filling its fertile deltas to ash. Magma bombs and mass drivers boiled away the rivers and reduced fecund earth to arid dust. The Cadmean citadel was left untouched, and Cassander still found it difficult to believe that such a precise bombardment was possible. He knew why, of course. The Iron Warriors could not pass up this chance to humble the Sons of Dawn, and Cassander had rallied his men with grim certitude as the bulk landers of the Fourth Legion descended on towering columns of firelight. The technological cunning of the ancient fortress builders, married to the artfully wrought geography and the courage of the defenders, had kept the Iron Warriors at bay for almost 3 months, but now Cassander's defiance was almost at an end. With 3/4 of his company slain and thousands of mortal soldiers dead, he was running out of ways to fight. The citadel had few heavy guns remaining to keep the Iron Warriors from bringing their artillery superiority to bear and overwhelming the citadel's inbuilt defense mechanisms. The traitors could not be denied for much longer. But every day, Cassander's warriors stayed alive, kept the enemy from redeploying and bringing their strength to bear elsewhere. A poor measure of success, but it was all Cassander had left. He shook off such pessimism, knowing it did not become a warrior of the Imperial Fists to wallow in self-pity, and moved to the edge of the northernmost bastion. Once, its gleaming ramparts had been a proud example of the military engineer's art. Now they were chewed up ruins in waiting. Locris and Castor crouched behind the largest nubs of dusty stone, golden giants amid the hundreds of dusty, ochre-clad local militiamen. Cassander had broken up his few remaining squads, deploying his men throughout the defence to bolster each section of wall and provide strength of heart to the thousands of soldiers who fought alongside them. The sky strobed with concussive impacts that buckled the air with their force. High explosives on ballistic trajectories flashed and screeched as their impact violence was dissipated by the void umbra. The shields on the southern approaches were close to failing, but thankfully the enemy wasn't concentrating fire there. Locris looked up as Cassander hunkered down in the lee of the rampart, and Castor gave him a nod of acknowledgement. "They're eager today," said Castor, as a thunderous detonation rocked the base of the wall. Kinetic dampers in the citadel's plunging foundations transferred the power of the blast deep into the bedrock of the mountain, and the smell of metal shavings and oily secretions wafted up from the silicate scabs forming over the craters. Rock fragments rained down onto the ramparts, blanketing the long line of soldiers in yet more red dust. "Too eager," agreed Locris. "Something's happening. The pace has changed." Like Cassander, Locris went bareheaded. The same shrapnel fragment that split his battle helm in two had given him the long scar down his cheek and taken his left eye. The scar made him roguish, the eye piratical. Both were wounds to be avenged. The plastron, pauldrons, and greaves of Castor's armour were scorched black where the firestorm of an incendiary projectile had peeled the paint from its plates as he shielded a group of wounded soldiers with his body. "What do you think, Captain?" "The digger?" asked Castor. "I told you Simeon's squad spotted the digger in the east today," said Locris. "This feels like scrappers' men." Cassander gripped the hilt of his sword and peered through a split in the rampart where webs of connective stone tissue had failed to set, watching the uphill avalanche of burnished iron plate through a haze of dust. Smoke-wreathed artillery pits in sheltered batteries far below hurled high-velocity projectiles ahead of the climbing iron warriors, while mobile guns on walker platforms struggled to keep up with the assault force. This fresh attack was a salutary reminder that Perturabo's sons were warriors first and foremost, siege specialists second. Cassander watched their movements, fluid and aggressive, disciplined, yet driven by core-deep fury. Where had such raw hate come from? They had taken to distinguishing between the Iron Warriors' detachments by giving their commanders derogatory appellations based on their most apparent characteristics. The Diggers' men were bent-backed shovelers, methodical, precise, and unstinting in their labours. The Malingerer kept his men in their dugouts as his artillery dropped tons of munitions on the citadel. The Voyeur liked to watch proceedings from a spike-topped blockhouse in the centre of the valley.
"I think you're right, Locris," said Cassander. Unlike his fellow commanders, Scrapper liked to throw his men at the walls if so much as a sniff of an assault opportunity presented itself. Where other Iron Warriors displayed a measure of caution towards the Citadel's defences and an appreciation for the careful step-by-step methodology of siege warfare, Scrapper liked to get his legionaries bloody in the swirling crucible of combat.
Cassander dropped back into cover as a whining solid slug zipped overhead.
"Makes it easier, I suppose," noted Castor. "His men have no fire discipline worth a damn." "Maybe not, but they're hard fighters," said Cassander. "We give them insulting names, but don't ever underestimate them." "Duly noted, Captain," said Castor, placing a fist in the centre of his scorched breastplate. Locris held up a spoon-handled detonator trigger and said, "You want the pleasure of these ones, Captain?"
Cassander risked another glance through the rampart as the Citadel's artillery pieces opened up on the advancing Iron Warriors. Those guns alone weren't going to make much of a dent in the assault force, but any thinning of the ranks could only be a good thing.
"You do it," he said. "You've more than earned it."
Locris grinned and mashed the trigger, detonating the last of the seismic mines dug into the northern slopes at the forefront of the Iron Warriors' attack. Mushrooming blasts of tectonic shockwaves ripped a 300-metre section of the mountain away and sent it tumbling downhill in a storm of pulverised rock. Cassander relished the sight of scores of split-open bodies carried downhill in the raging avalanche, and pressed the throat bead of his borrowed vox.
"All fists! Any movement in your sectors?"
Each of his section leaders replied in the negative, lending further credence to his growing certainty that this was Scrapper's latest attempt to break the citadel open with a surprise assault. The tempo of the unequal artillery duel picked up as the Iron Warriors drew ever closer, climbing through the deep ditch carved by the seismic mines.
"Simeon, Esdras, Phyros," said Cassander into his throat mic, "redeploy your men to the northern bastion immediately."
The enemy artillery shifted their aim as the Iron Warriors closed the last 100 metres between them and the wall. Shells screamed on direct flight paths, slamming into the wall with pounding hammer blows that shook the foundations of the mountain itself. A pressure wave of impact blew up and over the wall, and the heat of incendiaries burned at the silicate scabs fighting to resist the detonations. Cassander knew this was the last chance he would have to blunt the assault force before the Iron Warriors were tearing at the defenders.
"Wait until they reach the closest markers," he ordered, bellowing in a voice that could reach from one end of the phalanx's training halls to the other. "Make every shot count, or it won't be Perturabo's whelps you need to worry about."